This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the beginning of the hour. John Armour is with us. He is the legal counsel to the American Civil Rights Union, not to be mistaken for the American Civil Liberties Union. The American Civil Rights Union, the conservative counterpoint, I guess, their website, theacru.org. Mr. Armour has practiced law in the United States Supreme Court since 1974. He's the author of 7 books, more than 650 articles on constitutional law. And John Armour, welcome to the program.
It's a delight to be with you.
Thank you. Good to have you here with us. Some time ago, at the founding of this country, prior to the founding of this country, as we were fighting the Revolutionary War, George Washington issued a relatively famous order to his soldiers. I'm assuming you are familiar with it.
Which one? You have to be specific.
Regarding the treatment of prisoners of war.
Go ahead.
He was confronted with this horrible problem, and that is that when Americans were being taken prisoner of war by the British, they were routinely tortured. Many of them died of starvation. They were literally thrown into hellhole dungeons and just locked away, and they would starve.
Yeah, most of them held on ships in New York Harbor. Go ahead.
Many of them, yeah, and the horrible conditions.
And typhus and so forth.
That's right. And so George Washington issued an order saying that all British soldiers captured were to be treated humanely to show the world what America stood for, what we stood for. And he said, give none of them an opportunity to claim to complain about their care under our or their, you know, their the way that their treatment under our care. And this did two things. Number one, it radically increased the rate at which British soldiers started surrendering. And in fact, many of them, there's a startling number of British soldiers stayed on as U.S. citizens after the Revolutionary War. And number two, it helped establish the United States as a moral force. I mean, all over the world, people looked at this and said, whoa, we're a moral force. Your organization is arguing that we should essentially spit in the face of George Washington and say, habeas corpus, we don't need no stinking habeas corpus, even though it's in the Constitution, it goes back to the 10th century, to the 11th century. And just, you know, with regard to these people who have not even been charged with crimes down in Guantanamo, that they should not have the right to U.S. courts. I don't get it.
Well, first of all, you're missing a major point. You remember the hanging of Major John Andre by George Washington?
Yes.
Okay.
I would say one exception does not make a rule.
No, it is a rule. It's part of the law of war, which you apparently misunderstand. Major John Andre was behind American lines in civilian clothes, hiding among the civilian population. He was the British contact for Benedict Arnold in the attempted betrayal of West Point. And when Andre was captured and they found documents in his boot showing the betrayal by Benedict Arnold, he was tried by a military tribunal, which is then called a drumhead trial, and sentenced to death. And Washington sent word to the British that he would release Andre if Benedict Arnold was turned over. The British refused, so Andre was hanged.
Right, but being a spy during time of war, I mean, one of my very best friends was arrested as a spy during World War II. He was out of uniform, he was behind enemy lines, and spent 4 years in a prisoner of war camp under sentence of death. That's a completely different thing.
Well, no, it's not a different thing from the people at Gitmo, because, and remember, Nathan Hale was hanged under the same law of war by the British on Long Island. He was a colonel in the Connecticut militia. He was in civilian clothes. He was sneaking around Manhattan trying to find out what sort of emplacements, gun emplacements, and military construction there was there. He was discovered. He was tried by a military tribunal and was hanged and executed. This was the law of war was incorporated into U.S. law by the Congress in 1789. I assume you know that. And that was recognized as valid by the Supreme Court in 1942 in the Quirin case unanimously, where they held that 8 German saboteurs were properly tried by military tribunals, not by ordinary U.S. courts. And by the way, in that case, the Supreme Court did the review because it said, yes, we still have habeas corpus. Therefore, these 8 German saboteurs, at least one of whom is an American citizen, by the way, had a right to go to the Supreme Court and question whether they were properly tried. And then the Supreme Court decided unanimously they were properly tried.
But you're challenging the right of the people in Guantanamo to go before the Supreme Court.
No, quite contrary. Habeas corpus has not been suspended. And the current,
you've not read the Military Commissions Act?
And the current Supreme Court review is in line with the Quirin case from 1942, which, by the way, was recognized as good law by the Hamden case, which was the last time the Supreme Court took a look at the subject. So the simple fact is the law of war still applies, and by the way, it also applies under the Hague Convention and all 4 of the Geneva Conventions. When you are out of uniform, without a visible weapon, without being part of a unit, and hiding among the civilian population, you are not, I repeat, not entitled to the provisions of the Geneva Convention.
It's within the country that is under attack.
What?
Within the country that is under attack, and if you are an agent of an alien enemy. I mean,
number one, it doesn't matter whether you're in a country that's under attack or not. The 8 Germans were arrested on the beaches in the United States and never got to attack anybody because...
No, but that's the point. They were arrested in the United States. When we arrested Germans in Germany, we didn't try them as spies. There were reasonable trials. I mean, in fact, the United States and the Western powers, as a consequence of the Nuremberg trials, helped spread democracy around the world, helped spread the idea that we are a nation of laws, a nation of rules, that we respect human rights.
That did not end the law of war. I have seen movies of Germans being executed by firing squad after military trials in Germany under the occupation. Most of them were associated with the werewolves. Are you familiar with the werewolves?
I'm not.
That was a German organization set up by Himmler just before the fall of Germany, and they were intended to use assassination, which they did, to attack telegraph lines, electrical installations, and when they could, the occupying forces. When they were captured, they were tried by military tribunals, not by ordinary civilian courts. They were not considered prisoners.
Here's what I don't get, John. Let's just
killed. Hello.
Yeah. No. No. I understand. Let's just boil this down though to a really simple thing.
Okay.
It seems to me that what is happening right now is that we are behaving like the old terrible stereotype of a housewife standing on top of a kitchen table as a mouse is running around the floor. We have more people in the United States die from tobacco in a week than have died from terrorism in the last 15 years.
Well, what? That's an irrelevant point.
It is not an irrelevant point. We are not setting aside civil liberties for tobacco. Why go after the Constitution?
You're acting on the assumption we're setting aside civil liberties. What I have said repeatedly, and history shows it, is under the law of war, certain people can be tried by military tribunals in secret rather than public trials.
But the Bush administration...
If found guilty, can be executed. And this is not uncivilized behavior. In fact, it is recognized by the Hague Convention and all for the Geneva Convention.
But the Bush administration has made this an absolutely sweeping process with hundreds of people, many of whom were picked up in Afghanistan as a result of bounties that we were paying of up to $1,000 per person, which is huge money in Afghanistan, where you know, average income is less than $500 per year. And they have been charged with nothing, most of these people. And if the Bush administration had had its way, they never would have been charged with anything.
They also don't have to be charged with anything. Keep in mind, an ordinary POW can be held for the duration of the war without being charged. The people who invaded Germany on D-Day, who included my wife's father, did not go in with warrants saying arrest Fritz and arrest Schultz. They did not go in with arrest warrants to bring people to justice, that dreadful phrase that George Bush keeps babbling on about. They went to kill their opposition as efficiently as possible.
That's war. I mean, you've got people who are drivers and barbers.
We are at war. And
with whom?
What?
With whom? Are you suggesting that Germany was at war with the Baader-Meinhof gang?
We are at war because Congress...
Was Italy at war with the Red Brigades?
Congress has declared war, and that's all it takes for us to be at war.
Congress has declared war against whom?
This is the second time in American history we declared war without naming a nation. The other time was when we went after the Barbary Pirates in 1805, and Congress used much the same language in 2001 that it used in 1805.
Well, that's an interesting argument. John Armour, the ACRU.org, the website. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for calling me in.
Sure.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll free all across the United States. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, the websites, blogging over at AirAmerica.com. You want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com, also our message boards over there. My recollection is that Jefferson authorized the use of force against the Barbary Pirates, but he also negotiated with them, and... Unfortunately, John is not here to continue that conversation, but it's just, I don't frankly recall Congress having declared war. And this is one of the big problems that I think that we have, frankly, is that we have engaged in a number of armed conflicts since World War II without declarations of war, and I consider them, all of them, unconstitutional. Hillary Clinton weighed in on this on the floor of the Senate back about a year ago, and I thought that her point was really well made. And, tragically, my computer will not play the audio of it, but I hopefully can share it with you after the break. I mean, we're trying to figure this out. Dan in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Two quick points. One I was thinking about earlier this morning, but the first one for your guest. The absurdity of his logic would mean that if the United States said we're in a war against drugs, which we've said many times, then we could theoretically just go in and at drug dealers and round them up and do the same thing by saying we're at war with them. And my second, probably more important point is that it's just how we frame this issue. I remember how Kerry was ridiculed for saying it's a law enforcement issue, and the arrests in Germany this morning just were totally reinforced. My immediate thought was they're crime fighters and their investigations uncovering these plots, not the military, waiting for something to happen and then going and invading a third party.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, the arrests in Germany, I think, also highlight the point that this isn't, let's not be terrified here. Let's deal with this appropriately. Let's put together systems to appropriately deal with the problem. Yes, there are some crazies out there. There's a whole variety of them who are associated with a whole variety of different religions and worldviews and whatnot. From Tamil separatists in Sri Lanka to as I said, the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany to the, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And just the whole idea that we should all be terrified by this, I'm sorry, I'm just not buying it anymore, and that we should eviscerate the Constitution as a consequence of it, I'm not buying that anymore either. I think it's just absolutely wrong. It's not a road that we should be going down. Dan, thanks for the call and point well made. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David.
Great comment, Tom. Another point, your guest seems to think that the Congress's authorization to use military force in Afghanistan and Iraq is open-ended, and it's not. And in fact, to me, it seems like the authorization expired when Bush declared mission accomplished. So everything since that point seems to be a massive war crime, wouldn't you say?
I think you could argue that, yeah. Although, even beyond that, I would submit to you that the ways that this war was conducted, and particularly the way that the occupation has been conducted since then, is also a massive war crime. So, point well made, David. Thank you. I think I've got the audio on this. Now, let's just see if we can make this work. Apparently, it's not going to. One.
When General Washington led his soldiers across the Delaware River onto victory in the Battle of Trenton, he captured nearly 1,000 foreign mercenaries, and he faced a crucial choice. How would General Washington treat these prisoners? The British had already committed atrocities against Americans, including torture. As David Hackett Fisher describes in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Washington's Crossing, thousands of American prisoners of war were treated with extreme cruelty by British captors. There are accounts of injured soldiers who surrendered being murdered instead of quartered. Countless Americans dying in prison hulks in New York Harbor. Starvation and other acts of inhumanity perpetrated against Americans confined to churches in New York City. Well, you can imagine, the light of our ideals shone dimly in those early dark days, years from an end to the conflict, years before our improbable triumph and the birth of our democracy. General Washington announced a decision unique in human history, sending the following order for handling prisoners: treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. George Washington understood that how you treat enemy combatants can reverberate around the world. We must convict and punish the guilty in a way that reinforces their guilt before the world and does not undermine our values.
Amen. Meanwhile, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe signed into law the controversial Interception of Communications Bill. Spokesman Nelson Kamisma of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change called it the dictator's toolkit. Secretary General Nakubi of the MCD faction said it's the final straw to the end of liberties in Zimbabwe. But the communications minister says same thing's being done in the U.S. by George Bush.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Humankind to survive some disasters for sure, like locusts and flash floods and flu. There's never a moment when we've been secure from the ills that the flesh is heir to. If it isn't a war, it's some gruesome disease. If it isn't disease, then it's war. But there's worse still to come, and I'm asking you please, how the world's gonna take any more? In 10 years, we're gonna have 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers. In 10 years, we're gonna have 1 million lawyers. How much can the poor nation stand? Help me sing it out. In 10 years, we're gonna
have... Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Let me just say, in defense of lawyers, if our president and vice president had been lawyers rather than businessmen, they may have had some understanding of our Constitution. And they may have had some understanding of the concept of a separation between the military and the civilian governance, and the fact that in the United States, the civilians are ultimately in charge. George Bush hiding behind Petraeus. And now a very troubling development, let's say. Bruce Ackerman writing about this. He's a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University and author of the book Before the New Attack. He wrote an op-ed piece in today's Financial Times. And it apropos of this whole issue of, you know, the Military Commissions Act has done away with habeas corpus for all practical purposes. The John Warner Defense Act has done away with posse comitatus, which says that the federal government cannot use the army against you and me on U.S. soil, from post-Civil War until the last time the Republicans had an opportunity to tinker with this stuff. Tragically, the army could not be used against us. We said, you know, we did that once. It was called the Civil War. We're never going to do it again. And the Constitution is quite clear. The founders and framers of this country did not want the military to be an independent power. They wanted it to be a power which was subordinate to civilians who were in turn responsive to the electorate. In other words, who were elected to public office. that the funding of the military would come through Congress, which is elected in the House of Representatives every 2 years and then the Senate every 6 years, and would be led by the commander-in-chief, who would be a civilian, who would be elected by the Electoral College, indirectly by the people, and that would be the President of the United States. So we're going down all these very strange roads at the same time. We're going down the road of, you know, with these semi-show trials, these military tribunals, where people are not allowed to see the evidence against them. They're not allowed to present a defense, or at least a practical defense, a reasonable defense. They don't have access to U.S. courts. Number one. Number two, our own rights here at home are being stripped away. And number three, now there's this blurring. And this, Bruce Ackerman pointed this out just absolutely brilliantly. And let me just share a little bit of this with you, and then we'll get to your calls. Bruce Ackerman today in the Financial Times, he writes, President George W. Bush's campaign to stay the course in Iraq is taking a new and constitutionally dangerous turn. When Senator John Warner recently called for a troop withdrawal by Christmas, the White House did not mount its usual counterattack. Now, this is the way typically it's done. I mean, they'll get somebody to assassinate the character of the person or of their wife, you know, in the case of Joe Wilson, or whatever, you know. But instead, the White House didn't mount the usual counterattack. Instead, again, Bruce Ackerman, it allowed a surprising champion to take its place, Major General Rick Lynch, a field commander in Iraq, summoned reporters to condemn Senator Warner's proposal as, quote, a giant step backwards, end quote. Now, here's what's so dangerous about this. Policy is made by civilians. Military policy, the goals, are made by civilians. The behavior of the military is overseen and approved by civilians. You will recall Douglas MacArthur, during the Korean War, wanted to attack China. He wanted to just go full bore. We're not just going to take out North Korea. We're going to take out their sponsor state. We're going to attack China. And Harry Truman said no and fired him. Now, that singular act by Harry Truman pretty much sealed his fate. He became so unpopular as a result of that, because MacArthur was a very, very popular general, that he didn't even bother running for re-election. And Eisenhower came in, you know, ran for re-election and won on the singular campaign issue, primarily. I mean, you know, he talked about peace and prosperity. But his primary campaign issue, Eisenhower's, in the election of 52, I think it was, or would it have been 48? No, I think it was, you know, I wasn't paying attention at the time, and so I don't remember. But in any case, Eisenhower came into office. Yeah, it would have been 52. So Eisenhower came into office on the campaign platform of vote for peace. Right, that he would end the Korean conflict, that he would go even the next step. In fact, here's his campaign ad.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
And people were sick of war at that point. And so when a military man started speaking up about what our policy should be, even what our military policy should be, the President of the United States slapped him down and fired his butt. Harry Truman fired him. And Eisenhower, by the way, supported that, because he understood that the military should not be running the show. That's called Pakistan right now. But Bush now is increasingly having the military out front and having military officers not making policy, certainly stating policy, and constantly he's saying we're going to defer to the judgment of the military on the ground, when in fact the way it's set up, there should be civilians, perhaps former military civilians like Colin Powell type civilians, but nonetheless it should be the civilian government that we elect that is answerable to us. The military is not answerable to us. Major General Rick Lynch is not, you know, I can't vote for or against him. General Petraeus, I can't vote for or against him. The Republican Party, I can vote for or against. As Bruce Ackerman notes in today's Financial Times, once again, nobody is noticing the threat to civilian control. Nobody remarked on the breach. He says Major General Lynch was making the giant step into forbidden territory. He had no business engaging in a public debate with a U.S. senator. His remarks represent an assault on the principle of civilian control, the most blatant so far during the Iraq War. And nobody in the media has remarked on the breach. And Bruce Ackerman says, but this makes it all even more troubling. Once again, nobody is noticing the threat to civilian control. Mr. Bush has pushed General Petraeus into the foreground to shore up his badly damaged credibility. In doing so, he has made himself a hostage. Bush. He needs the general more than the general needs him. Despite the president's grandiose pretensions as commander-in-chief, the future of the Iraq War is up to General Petraeus. And Ackerman goes on, he says, in fact, if not in name, it will be an army general who's calling the shots, not the duly elected representatives of the American people. And he adds, he says, this puts General Petraeus in a difficult constitutional position. Paradoxically, it's now up to a military man to defend the principle of civilian control. And the question is legitimately raised, will he do it? This is these guys, they genuinely don't understand the Constitution. They don't understand how America works. And as pointed out with the brilliant speech by Hillary Clinton on the floor of the Senate some months ago, and she, of course, was not the only one saying such things, but she was the only one that I knew of, you know, on the floor of the Senate who referred to George Washington's decision. It was just a perfect, eloquent moment. Are we going to be the moral leader of the world, or are we going to be the leader that Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, one of the world's most brutal and heinous dictators who has killed 2 million of his own people in the last 10, 12 years, are we going to be the nation that Mugabe quotes and says, oh, I'm just doing what America does? Ron in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, man? I love the show, Tom.
Thank you.
The guest that you had on in the first segment of the show had several examples of, you know, people being brought before a military tribunal and stuff like that. But what he fails to realize is that during that time, habeas corpus was still in for the rest of the population. And
well, and not only that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, George Bush has essentially convicted everybody, you know, before anybody has done anything,
right?
And just left it open for everyone to be convicted that way, no matter what.
Plus the legal rationale. My understanding, I may be wrong on this, and if I am, somebody correct me. But I don't think I am. The legal rationale for a military tribunal is that when you are on the battlefield and things are happening really fast, there isn't always time for recourse to the civilian courts. And the military has to have some way of maintaining law and order. It may not be the absolute civilian law and order, but there has to be some way. There has to be some, you know, a way to convict people who are guilty, and B, some way for people who have been charged with crimes to defend themselves. And so military commissions are, you know, military tribunals are a step in that direction. They're an attempt to say, okay, you know, yes, we realize there will be exceptions, but the Bush administration has made them the rule rather than the exception. And it's not on the battlefield. It's 6 years later. And it's not in Afghanistan. It's in Cuba. And it just gets weirder, and not to mention the people who have been, you know, rendered to other countries for torture and whatnot. It's terrible. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
That's what I like about you. That's what I like about you. And speaking of what I like about you, Dave McDonald, one of our listeners, sent me a note. This is absolutely brilliant. In fact, congratulations, Dave, our jolly good fellow. He says, Tom, your eloquence on the 11th hour. He apparently saw the movie, the 11th hour, Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie. He says, kept me up last night while I made this calculation. Gasoline is the elaborate biological, geological, man-made byproduct of lipids from diatoms in the sea. So I wanted to get an idea of how much solar energy it would take to do this in a laboratory. He says, I was totally shocked to find out that the basic figure for ocean productivity of diatoms as approximately 100 kilocalories per square meter per year. And the average solar energy striking that square for photosynthesis is 7,300, I'm assuming this is millijoules, MJ, per square meter per year, and that the average liter of petrol contains 7,880 kilocalories. Then he does the math, it takes 79 years of solar energy and photosynthesis over one square meter to make the equivalent of 1 liter of petrol. So here's the bottom line. So one average car over a year burns 144,000 years of solar energy from the past. Brilliant, Dave. Thank you so much. 866-303-2270, our number. Kip. Hey, Kip, what's up?
Hi. I'm a veteran of World War II, and I just want to tell you, you are absolutely correct about Eisenhower being elected in 52, because I voted for him after having served under him in Europe 6 years before, and he was the first president I voted for and the only Republican. Now, in the matter of this military leadership, as shown by Petraeus and Bush's pushing of Petraeus, I think that is a terrible, terrible situation that we're in right now. I agree with you totally. The decider is no longer deciding, but I thought we were the decider. And where is our Congress as the people who are supposed to show everybody what we have decided? My question.
And also, where is the media pointing out the fact that we are a nation of civilians, run by civilians, our military is under civilian control, and it's insane that the commander-in-chief would be telling us, the people, that the decisions that are supposed to be made by our elected representatives, specifically him,
exactly,
are actually going to be made by military officers,
exactly,
instead, who are not elected, and they're not supposed to be making policy. They're supposed to be executing policy.
I thought you put your finger on it beautifully, and that person you quoted also. But
Bruce Ackerman.
To this point, I'd like to hear your current thinking about it as briefly or as elongated as you would like. Where is Congress regarding impeachment now? Because there have been these new outrages, the Petraeus outrage. I think impeachment is even more on the table than it ever was. Where's that going?
I think impeachment is more justified than it ever was. My conversation with Bruce Fine, we're going to have to replay that one of these days, or else just get him back on and have a conversation with him. The problem is that as we move into the political season, and we very much are, I mean, the election of 2008 is now kicked off. It's post-Labor Day. Any effort at impeachment now is going to be seen as a purely political move. And so, practically speaking, as much as I am a vigorous supporter of the impeachment, particularly of Dick Cheney, but also of George W. Bush, I can't imagine that it's going to happen.
I can't either, but it should, because the Constitution says it's our way to control these guys who decide without deciding.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well said. I love it. Thank you. Thank you, Kip. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Norman in Los Angeles. Hey, Norman.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Just fine, but okay. I'll get better. What's up?
We saw the 11th hour, and I got to see what you looked like, and I listen to you all the time. You're terrific. One of the logical outcomes of that movie was that Al Gore is clearly the best the possible candidate for this country, and I've heard you say that you'd do anything to get him to go, and he didn't want to run. But I think it's incumbent upon us to, in a sense, draft him, to let him know how popular he is, how much we need him, and encourage him. This is the time. Earlier it wouldn't have been good, and I can't go on too much longer.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I think it's quite clear, Norman. I don't disagree with you. And as I said, if Al Gore were in the race, I'd be doing just about everything I could to help make him successful. That said, though, I think that John Edwards is just as strong a candidate. I also like Dennis Kucinich a lot. And as I've said many, many times, even if it's one of the other candidates who I am not as enthusiastic about, I am not opposed to them. And frankly, it's not about the candidate. It's not about the leader. It's about us. If enough of us get out there and if we push these candidates in the appropriate directions, they will move in those directions. That's what history has shown over and over and over again. It's just a matter of us getting out there and getting active. Jack in San Francisco. Hey, Jack.
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know what? I get so upset with people. I'm talking specifically about your interview that you had at the beginning of the show,
right.
with the man who
Mr. Armour.
Yeah, who you know apparently wants us to go back to the times before the Magna Carta. Look, you know what we can't. You know, being able to have the right to a trial is something that is absolutely essential. That and this man is in the wrong country. He needs to. If he thinks he's American, he's wrong. He needs to go to Saudi Arabia or a dictatorship somewhere else in the world, because that is that is not America. America is not a place where we sacrifice our civil liberties for whatever reason. You know,
without speaking directly of Mr. Armour, because he's not here to defend himself. The larger point is that which is the point that Hillary made in that speech is that, and that George Washington made in his order to his troops, is that we stand for something in the United States. And if we start employing the tactics of our enemies, we become our enemies, and we can't allow that to happen. Jack, you said it very, very eloquently. Thank you very much. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Just a few, half a minute here before we've got to wrap up, Ralph, this hour anyway.
Yeah, remember, Tom?
Ralph, you got to pick up the phone.
Yeah, Tom?
Thank you.
You're talking about people like Washington and Adams and Franklin. Remember that they were rebels. They were not part of a government. Consequently, what the British did are illegal. That's what we're doing for Greg.
Well, that's an interesting comment. You're right. And there was a sort of a flipping of roles. The British were the legally constituted government at the time. But nonetheless, they were the founders of this nation, and it's their vision that we need to be carrying forward. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
This is interesting. FreeRepublic.com is a whole discussion over there about whether or not the declaration of war on the Barbary pirates is actually a declaration of war, and whether it should be used as the rationale, as our guest in the first hour did, for the so-called war on terror. Now, we'll get into that in some more detail as we go on through the week. Right now, I'd like to reset the topic to an issue that frankly is going to hit home for a lot of people. And there's a micro issue here, and then there's a macro issue. There's a small issue, and then there's a much larger issue. Let's start out with the small issue. This is an article that was in the money section of CNN's website, CNN.com. And it actually came out of FSB magazine. I'm not sure what that is, but that's the byline by Ian Mount over at CNN Money. A Midwestern hospital operator, Clarion Health, caused a stir when it announced that next year, employees who smoke will be assessed $5 per paycheck in extra insurance copayments. We're talking health insurance here, not life insurance. And then in 2009, it will extend the penalty to workers with high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high blood glucose. That they're all going to pay an extra $5, and obese employees will be charged an extra $10. Final federal rules for such programs went into effect in July, giving employers firm legal footing to push workers into healthier lifestyles, the article continues. Now, over in England, there's an attempt to do something very similar. This, they have a national health care plan. Failing to follow a healthy lifestyle, this is from thislondon.co.uk, entertainment guide, actually, it's a newspaper. Failing to follow a healthy lifestyle could lead to free National Health Service treatment being denied under the Tory plans, the Conservative Party's plans. Patients would be handed NHS, National Health Service, health miles cards. This is like a frequent flyer card for when you do good things, allowing them to earn reward points for losing weight, giving up smoking, receiving immunizations, or attending regular health screenings. Like a supermarket loyalty card, the points could be redeemed as discounts on gym membership and fresh fruit and vegetables, or even given priority for other public services such as jumping the queue for council housing. The NHS already demands that obese patients lose weight before receiving hip replacements, for example. So they say, you know, there's some precedent for this. So the question, the micro question, is it appropriate for employers, for private health insurance companies, or for a National Health Service plan to say to people, if you are obese, you're going to pay more for your health care? And if so, now that's the micro question. And on its surface, it would seem that, you know, saying to a smoker, hey, if you're going to smoke, you're going to have to pay more for your health care because it's going to cost more over time in all probability. Statistically, the odds are it's going to cost more. If you're obese, you're going to pay more for your health care because over time, it would seem that, you know, it's going to cost more. But just consider where this goes, where this logic goes. I'm strongly opposed to this. And here's why. Because the logic of this is, this is the me logic, the me society logic, rather than the we society logic. The logic of this is that the job of government is the same as the job of private industry, which is to maximize efficiency and reduce costs. And I reject that. I submit to you that the job of government is to do what's best for society, and it may not always be the most efficient. Now, obviously, what's best for society is to reduce obesity and reduce smoking. But if we start rationing health care or using financial penalties for those things, then the next step is not that far away. So this is like going down the eugenics road. Keep in mind, the United States was the leading proponent of eugenics in the world in the 1920s. Eugenics, killing off people with bad genes, preventing people from bad genes from breeding, from having babies, involuntarily sterilizing people who were, quote, defective, end quote. When I lived in Vermont, I learned that the entire Abenaki Native American community in Vermont had been, in the 1920s, had been ordered to be sterilized. I mean, so that's, and then Hitler was using American eugenics posters to promote his eugenics program in Germany to create the master race, and then that led to the ultimate solution. Oh, well, you know, if we're going to get rid of bad people, well, let's get rid of the gays, let's get rid of the mentally retarded. That's where they started out, was actually with mentally retarded. And, you know, where did it lead? You know, it led to the Holocaust. So do we go after fat people? Do we go after smokers when, in particular, when it may be that people who are obese are not necessarily obese because they've made lousy choices, and people who are smokers are not necessarily smokers because they've made lousy choices, because there are genes that make some people more predisposed to addictions like nicotine. In fact, about 5% of the population is genetically immune from addiction to nicotine. About 5% of the population of humans can take or leave, can use nicotine occasionally. It's called chipping. Can occasionally use nicotine and never get addicted to it. Some studies indicate that as many as 70 or 80% of people can use alcohol with some regularity and never get addicted to it. But there's a small percentage that are genetically predisposed to addiction. So if we're going to say that your condition, which reflects your lifestyle in theory, is something that we're going to penalize you with financially, where will this end? Now here, let me just share a couple more quick stories with you. In British Columbia, so this is how it should be done. With 1 in 4 British Columbia school-aged children overweight or obese, the provincial government has launched a shape-up plan it says is the most aggressive in Canada. Now, this is, instead of punishing, this is like doing it right. The BC Education Ministry will require all students to have at least 30 minutes of physical activity a day by next September and accelerate a plan to clear junk foods from schools starting in January. The number of Canadian children who walk or bicycle to school has dropped to 20% from more than 50% in the 1980s, and a quarter of kids' waking hours are spent before a video screen of some kind. That's a problem. Now, here's where it gets even stranger. This is from The Guardian. It's the science column. It's written by Alok Jahad, the science correspondent. The headline, Skinny Gene Could Become Weapon in Fight Against Obesity. Scientists have uncovered a gene which could be a key to whether a person piles on the pounds. It's called the adipose gene. It's first discovered in fruit flies more than 50 years ago. Now they've identified it in people. On top of that, they've also, this is in Science News this week. Yesterday I shared, you know, from Science News with you. This is another article. It's in the same issue, the current issue of Science News. 25 years ago, researchers discovered that certain viruses can cause obesity in some animals. Now, the animals aren't sitting around going, gee, I think I'll go for a Twinkie today. No. A decade ago, they extended the finding to people. Now a team reports that one such virus works by transforming adult stem cells into fat-storing cells. The finding supports the notion that some cases of obesity may be infectious. This is research done at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. They identified the virus as the adenovirus-36. Adenoviruses, by the way, are the viruses that cause the common cold. This is one of thousands of them. This is called adenovirus-36. They studied 502 obese and normal weight people and found that among the obese group, 30% of them showed clear signs of previous adenovirus 36 infections, whereas among the lean group, it was only 11%. In lab tests, when they infected chickens, rodents, and monkeys with this virus, they became obese. So we're going to penalize people for having had an infection. And then it gets even stranger. In Britain now, this is from The Guardian. Judge wants everyone in UK on DNA database. The entire UK population and every visitor to Britain should be put on the national DNA database, a top judge said today. Now, they're talking about it in the context of law enforcement, but they also have a national health program. And we know now, we've identified at least 300 genetically associated diseases. If we start set this precedent of saying, well, if you're obese, it's going to cost you extra to be on the health program. What happens if you have a gene that predisposes you to breast cancer? Oh, you get to pay an extra $100 a month for your health insurance. What if you have the gene that predisposes you to prostate cancer? What if you have a gene that predisposes you to melanoma? What if you have the gene that predisposes you to bowel cancer? Are we going to jack up the payments on everybody? Where does it end? Your thoughts. Right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
I always ask for more, and they call me Mr. Natural. On down to the health food store, I only eat good sea salt. White sugar don't touch my lips, and my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night, I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth.
Welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Yes. Is it? Yeah. See, here. This is incredible stuff. I have a friend who was of absolutely normal weight until he was around 7, 8 years old. He had appendicitis, went into the hospital, had an appendectomy, and within a month or so started gaining weight and quite quickly, and struggled with being overweight all his life. Still does. I mean, this is, you know, now it's 50 years later, and you wonder, you know, with this discovery of adenovirus 36, if he just, you know, caught the virus in the hospital. And at what point are we going to punish people for that? You know, or don't we? And like I said, you know, how does it go beyond that? Lee in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I have both obesity, I had a heart attack, and I am diabetic. And the diabetes kicked in after I was in the hospital, and I had been given a drug that triggered the diabetes, which, ouch, I had never had before. But when I went in for my and had a heart attack and went into rehabilitation, I noticed that most of the people in rehabilitation in the hospital were all skinny.
Mm-hmm.
Skinny people have heart attacks.
Yeah, and it's true.
A lot of people who have been big fitness gurus and have written books about running and jogging, they've actually had heart attacks while they've been jogging.
Yeah, well, the most famous was this was about 25 years ago now, the guy who was probably the leading proponent of jogging in the United States. I can't remember his name now, it's been so long, but he just, you know, dropped dead in his, as I recall, in his 30s. He's out jogging.
In his 30s, I think he was actually running at the time or something.
Yeah, he was. He had a genetic, but it turned out he had a genetic heart defect. And that's,
right.
And that's the question is, if we start saying, okay, we're going to single out individual, see, the whole point of insurance is that you share the risk across as broad a range as possible. And frankly, I think that if we're, as a society, if we're going to try and do something about smoking and drinking, and for that matter, even things like obesity, that we should do it in a way that is educational and that is cooperative rather than punitive. And on the other hand, if we're going to provide health care to everybody in this country, or if we're going to allow health insurance companies to provide health care to people, we should be saying to them, sorry, you can't discriminate based on somebody's DNA, based on somebody's lifestyle choices, based on what they're doing, because once we start going down that road, particularly a for-profit corporation, once we start going down that road can lead to some very scary places.
Well, and I think that a lot of this is the greedy spirit of corporate insurance companies. My grandfather, who passed away at 92, was also very heavy. It's sort of, we've had a lot of heavy people in our family. None of them have died from cancer. None of them have died from their overweightness. And he lived a very healthy, happy, active life, but he was a big man. And some people are just big people.
Yeah. Yeah. And but
they never get there.
Right. And well, in fact, the person I was referring to who you know, went through that surgery, very healthy most of his life. But in any case, Lee, point made, and I appreciate it. Joy in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Hey, Joy. Joy. Oh. Keith in Madison, New Jersey. Hey, Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. What was interesting in China post-World War II, most of the professionals had left that country, and they approached the martial artists in the country, and they said, we want you to teach the entire population Tai Chi. Those people who weren't involved in that program, literally if they had a stroke or a heart attack and they were brought to the hospital, if they checked their attendance card and they hadn't participated, they turned them away and let them die. These kinds of draconian measures I see from, I don't know, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to think about how the insurance companies are connected to the pharmaceuticals that are connected to the government. That, you know, it just, as you say, it's going to get more and more granular, and particularly when they own the genetic information.
Right, and which is happening very fast.
Exactly. They're able to screen you when you get a job. When you're 21, they say, well, it looks like, you know, your family died of heart ailments, and so we're not going to hire you.
Right. And there's actually, there's to some extent, that's already going on, and there are employers who do legally discriminate based on things like smoking. And, you know, it's that I think, frankly, is another area. But because, you know, having a job, offering a job is different than giving everybody health care. But you know, how far down this road do we want to go as a society? And are we going to start putting limits on it, or are we going to start embracing it? That's ultimately the question that we're facing right now. And I think, and Keith, thank you very much for your comments. I think that we have to be very, very careful about embracing such things. We've seen this movie before played out in a really, really bad way. Unless, you know, I mean, maybe you've got an argument you can convince me that there's some benefit in this, but I just, you know, the other assumption of this is that money is the ultimate motivator, and I don't buy that one either. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Radio. Some rise up.
And a special thanks to Phil Tower, who fills us in. The runner's name was Jim Fix. Yeah, good old Jim Fix. He was the guy. Thank you, Phil. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's the question. Should we use financial incentives within the healthcare system? Keeping in mind also that for some people who are living on the edge, a financial incentive may actually mean rationing. If, you know, they can no longer afford the copay, so they don't go. They don't get the service. Should we use financial incentives within the healthcare system to discourage or encourage particular behaviors that may ultimately actually affect the healthcare system in terms of its costs? Or should we use the many other levers that we have as a society, such as control and regulation of our food supply, such as education, such as exercise in public schools? Remember John Kennedy? Some of you are probably old enough to remember when John Kennedy declared national physical fitness. And all of us who hated phys ed all of a sudden had to go out and start exercising in elementary school. And it was no fun. But, hey, you know, I think a lot of us are still probably fairly fit as a consequence of it. So what do we do? How do we deal with this? And does it represent a threat to liberty, ultimately? David in Pasadena, California. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. It's not surprising to me that health insurance companies are trying to do this because, as a self-employed person who purchases health insurance outside of a group, every time I reach a new age category, they charge me way more than $5 extra.
Yeah.
That's pretty standard, and it's yep. Nothing I can do anything about either. I can't get younger.
Yeah, and the same thing, I've noticed the same thing over the years. Most of the last couple of decades, I've been buying my own health insurance, and I can tell you. And not only that, you know, if you get any kind of an illness of any consequence, particularly a chronic one, you know, and thank God I don't have like diabetes or something like that, but I know, you know, I have friends who have or other problems, then bang, you know, the premiums become so unaffordable, you know, because they're trying to get rid of you, basically. And the bottom line is that the first goal of a health insurance company, a for-profit health insurance company in the United States, is not to deliver health care. It's to deliver profits to its stockholders. And your point is well made, David. And delivering profits to stockholders, frankly, in my opinion, should not be the first goal of the organizations, the institutions to which we entrust our health care. Although that's a little bit of field of our topic. Warren in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Warren.
Hi, Tom. I don't think we have to penalize the ailment. We could take a tax, much like cigarettes and alcohol has, mm-hmm. on things like Cokes and Big Macs and Fritos.
A sugar
whatever,
tax.
And use that money to counter their slick advertising with education. Look how popular bottled water has become.
Yeah, or for that matter, regulate advertising. I mean, we have taken tobacco ads off the airwaves. Maybe there are other things that we should seriously consider taking off the airwaves. Good point, Warren. Yeah. Thank you very much. Well said. Coach Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Tom. Talking about health care and addictions, my stepson, my wife's British, it was beaten by three thugs who didn't even know him in the UK. He had a 10.5-hour operation, 7 titanium plates, his jaws all wired up. They almost destroyed his face where they couldn't rebuild it. Intensive care. Nurses, after he got out of the hospital, came to his house twice a day, then once a day. That kind of care would have cost probably upwards of $300,000 here. It cost him $0, and he's probably going to get, well, he is going to get about $30,000 victim compensation fund to re-enter his life. If that had happened here, we would have had to hire an air ambulance and fly him to England because it would have been cheaper.
Amazing. Glenn, thanks for the story. I mean, it's an example, again, of a we society versus a me society. And many of the countries in the world are embracing what is referred to as neoliberalism, which has nothing to do with liberal in the sense that we understand it in the United States. It's Reaganism, essentially, Thatcherism. They're embracing this notion of, you know, punish the person, punish the victim, and drive all the rewards up to the top of society. And it's not a good idea. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was kind of in agreement with Warren, I believe. He talked about how the HMOs are adding on the risk management cost to their members who have preconditions.
Right.
And I agree with him totally in that we should actually tax the source, not the consumer who'd been duped or marketed to the unhealthy lifestyle. We should have, you know, tobacco tax is not so unusual. We could certainly have a Twinkie tax or a cheeseburger tax.
Yeah, it's sort of the externalities. I mean, it's like, think about gasoline for a minute. The actual cost of gasoline in the United States is around $10 a gallon. And the reason why is because we're spending, we taxpayers are spending about $4 per gallon of gasoline on health care expenses that are related to the burning of fossil fuel, of gasoline in the United States.
Well, regarding
from asthma
tax,
to cancer.
Gas,
plus, we're paying about $4 per gallon of gasoline on the cost of maintaining a military to maintain our oil. These are externalities that the oil companies aren't paying for.
Why not,
and so if
you, why not put a tax on MTEB, which is an additive in gas? If that tax was added to the cost of gasoline, then people would say, well, we don't want to pay the tax to remove the chemical.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And the point with foods that we know are destructive, why not say, hey, you know, there are externalities associated with this food. You know, if you live on Twinkies, you're not going to be as healthy as if you live on fresh veggies. And so we're going to tax them differently because we're going to recover some of the cost of those externalities, or we're going to cause the company to pay for some of those externalities. Jan in Manhattan. Hey, Jan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I think that we should treat high fructose corn syrup and tobacco and lead the same way that we treat cocaine and heroin. They should be illegal and nobody should be allowed to sell them.
Yeah, but then what, arguably you're probably not going to see a huge black market spring up for high fructose corn syrup, but I'm not sure that criminalizing things is the solution. Criminalizing drugs has not stopped the use of drugs.
By raising their fees, why not?
No, but
put it where
but look, in the Netherlands, where pretty much all drugs are by and large legal and available, including hard drugs, the teenage use of drugs in the Netherlands is one quarter what it is in the United States, and the adult use of drugs in the Netherlands is about a third of what it is in the United States. I mean, not only does
grown-ups.
Pardon?
They're grown-ups. We're just teenagers.
Yeah, well, that's the point, and I think that criminalizing things in a certain way reinforces the idea that we're just kids and we can't make decisions for ourselves.
Well, the reason why I said
not wanting to sound too much like a libertarian.
How silly the whole thing is. I was in the store the other day trying to buy something that didn't have high fructose corn syrup in it and ended up walking out of the store. And I told them before I left that I couldn't find anything without it, and I was going over to my health food store.
Yeah. Well, I've gone through that when, you know, you want to have a chocolate bar or something and sugar craving and which we will be talking about in our next hour and just trying to find a product, trying to find ketchup, you know, without high fructose corn syrup. You're absolutely right, Jan. It should be banned. Just right off. Well, I shouldn't say it should be banned. Let me rephrase that. I am of the opinion, and this is my personal conspiracy theory, although there's a lot of folks out there who share that. If you look at the graph of consumption of high fructose corn syrup in the United States and you look at the graph of obesity in the United States, they lag each other by about 4 years. As more and more, and high fructose corn syrup really came in, really kicked in back in the 80s with when we started supporting with our tax dollars the growing of corn. And back in, it was in the 70s that they actually developed the technology. High fructose corn syrup is not a food. It's a chemical. And they developed the technology to make it. We're not talking about Karo syrup here, the stuff that we had forever. We're talking about a brand new chemical that was invented in the 70s, started marketing aggressively in the 80s. Coke changed their formula to get rid of cane sugar, replace it with high fructose corn syrup. And starting at that point, more or less, you can just track forward and you see obesity going up. Not to say that it's all Coke's fault, because it's in everything, as Jan was pointing out. Pam in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Pam.
Hi, Tom. I have a... three little comments I wanted to make. First of all, the drugs that people have to take for instance, bipolar, are, you know, the side effects. One of the side effects is obesity. And if you don't take those drugs, then you're, you know, at risk of being psychotic going into those episodes. So, and then there's the GMO issue, that genetically modified foods, that they have a lot of side effects from eating that we don't even know what they are yet. right. from eating that type of food. And you were sort of hinting with the high fructose, but there's a whole bunch of other. I mean,
no, there's some of the animal studies showing kidney damage and liver damage and things.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, you know, so that can affect your health, your obesity, your everything else. And then there's the issue of poverty. What about the people who can't afford the high quality foods, who can only afford the cheaper foods, which have more junk in it? And then we as a society are saying, oh, look at those poor people. They just eat all the fat. I mean, they just eat all this stuff and they're so fat and they're lazy and all that stuff. And I just think it's an issue of justice, of social justice.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree, and that's my point, Pam. And I'm frankly surprised I haven't had any libertarians call up and say, oh, no, wait a minute, the free market will solve all things. We'll just let the free market solve this one. Just charge more. And, you know, maybe one will call. Lauren, keep an eye out. Oh, me, we'll be back with your calls and thoughts on this. Is this a road we want to travel down? Because we are traveling down this road. We have been for some time, and a lot of other countries are as well. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Sing the only thoughts you know. You can feel it in your bare soul when you listen to the radio.
Hey, by the way, if you missed the Tom Hartman Program on C-SPAN on Friday, there's a link up at the top of my homepage, tomhartman.com. And also one over at airamerica.com on the Tom Hartman page blog that links right to the C-SPAN show. You can watch us on TV on your computer if you would like. Just go to the top of tomhartman.com and click the link right there. And also, we have another congratulations, jolly good fellow. I got this one. This came via Seattle is doing this, AM Talk 1090. But apparently it's an idea that started down in San Diego with KLSD. And I get this email, and at first I'm thinking, what is this? Progressive Talk, AM 1090, KPTK, needs your pledge. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, pledge drives? AM 1090 is asking listeners to consider making a pledge of their time to AM 1090. It's a promise to listen to their favorite radio station. We need your pledges now, and those are your friends. We don't want your money. We want your pledge to spend at least 2 hours every day listening to AM 1090, and your pledge that you will tell at least three friends to do the same. Isn't that cool? And then they've got a bunch of bullet points, other things that you can do to support. If you and your friends have businesses, call our sales department. Find out how you can advertise on AM 1090. Join Precinct 1090, or in the case of San Diego would be KLSD, all the stations. Actually, this is true of any of our stations. You know, join Precinct 1090, find out what's going on, how you can get involved. So they have an email blast list. Most of our radio stations have an email list you can join. Listen to the online or on the radio. Contact businesses that advertise on our station and thank them for supporting Progressive Talk Radio. Encourage other businesses you frequently contact, to contact us and find out how they can advertise as well. Call into your favorite show and share your views. Write a letter to the local paper about how much you value Progressive Talk Radio. Cool stuff. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And speaking of San Diego, California, Dan in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, good morning. You mentioned eugenics earlier, and I think that opens a real possibility of racism, you know, as certain diseases affect certain ethnicities more. You know.
That's right. The sickle cell penalty could be much greater than the blue-eye gene or whatever.
Yeah, or like Native Americans are more prone to alcoholism, you know, because of their metabolism, you know, things like that. And then also on where you talked about the heart disease or diseases being caused by infections picked up in the hospital, mm-hmm. along that same line, one of the things that they've come up with or they found out is like gum disease, you know, or certain infection in the blood that causes plaque, you know, to increase and or the formation of plaque to increase and makes you more prone to heart disease. So it's not inconceivable that you could pick up something in the hospital and boom, there you go, heart attack.
Right, and then they punish you for it. You're right, Dan. Good point. Lori in San Diego listening on KLSD. Hey, Lori.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a nurse here in San Diego, and I just wanted to let you know regarding the healthcare issue.
Mm-hmm.
The hospitals here are not legally allowed to turn away indigent patients. And so what the for-profit facilities do is, like, if somebody comes in critical condition and needs blood, they'll hang a unit of blood and then send them to another hospital.
Turning people away. Yeah, we saw this in Michael Moore's movie Sicko, the examples of that.
I haven't seen that yet. I want to see that.
You got to see it. You got to see it. It is absolutely incredible. Laurie, thanks for the call and the heads up. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Long time no talk.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've heard from you.
Yeah,
I'm glad you're still listening.
Hey, one thing I wanted to bring up, one other factor is the environment that you're in. And I'll give you an example. I am so much healthier when I go out west to Montana and Colorado and even Oregon than I am here in Indiana. Indiana is basically a big petri dish. And if you have chronic infection problems and even the nosocomial infections, the infections that you pick up in the hospital, you know, that's so much more prevalent here in this
right.
environment because, you know, so I think, you know, if we're going to start charging people based on what they eat and their habits, then maybe we should start charging industry about all the pollution that they put.
Right, or the flip side, the evil flip side of that would be to start charging people based on where they live. Didn't you pick up an infection in a hospital that led to hundreds of surgeries?
Are you kidding? I mean, that's how I lost my right arm. And that was in 89, back when MRSA, MRSA, was almost fatal. I mean, it was...
Right.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I'd had 334 surgeries, and I would say at least 80% of them were due to nosocomial infections. Now,
hospital acquired infections.
Yes.
And
anymore, you know, MRSA is not that big of a problem now, but now they've got bugs that make MRSA just look like, you know.
I know. Sean, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Great to hear from you, and good to know you're still there and you're doing well. Thank you very much. Gary in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You want to disagree with me, Gary?
Yes, I do. I believe the free market's working, and that's demonstrated by the growth of organic food industry, large.
But we're talking about health care here, and what we're seeing with health care in the United States is that we have slipped to the bottom of the pile among industrialized nations by most indices of health, you know, that have to do with the health care system.
Yeah, but I still believe it's working because, like McDonald's, Burger King, they're switching their cooking oils. I just think it's going to
be that's
a
not the healthcare
lot
slower
system. Than what we want.
Yeah, but that's not the healthcare system. What we're seeing is you know, millions of people, tens of millions of people who are uninsured or underinsured, who lack access to healthcare. 18,000 deaths a year from you know, this administration's very conservative projection, just as a result of a lack of healthcare. I don't see that as a marketplace working. I see that as a marketplace failing. But you know, your point is well taken that you know, McDonald's is getting a little healthier, but you know, is it going to just be cosmetic? Is it about, but you know, that's a for-profit company. That's not the healthcare industry. I'm concerned about the healthcare industry. 57 minutes past that.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, some of us are old enough to remember the Symbionese Liberation Army and Patty Hearst, the SLA. What about the Sugar Liberation Army? Is it time for that? Do we need the Sugar Liberation Army? Well, maybe. I don't know. It's, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you know, etc.
But you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything you know wrong about sugar? Connie Bennett is with us. She's the author of a new book called Sugar Shock, How Sweets and Simple Carbs Can Derail Your Life and How You Can Get Back on Track. Her website, sugarshock.com. Hey, Connie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are a sugar liberationist?
Yeah.
Sugar Liberation Coach, right. That's what I call myself.
That's pretty cool. First of all,
from the trenches, I used to be a major sugar addict.
Okay, and you're not any longer.
I am not anymore. No.
Now, is this sort of like alcoholism, where alcoholics claim that, or at least in AA, I guess, I'm not speaking for myself here, so I may have the facts wrong, but my understanding is that in AA, people say that, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic for life, and as opposed to I'm over that addiction and now I've moved on with my life. Do people get over sugar addictions and then their neurology or physiology changes and they're no longer, you know, a sugar addict, or is it something that people stop eating sugar, but they're still craving it and addicted to it for the rest of their lives?
I think they're different levels. I think that I think I used to be a sugar addict, but I don't think that I'm really one, but I don't think I wouldn't tempt it.
Yeah.
But I think that some people will tell you that they feel just like a drug addict or an alcoholic, and that if they have one bite, they'll go back.
Well, and in fact, I've actually seen some science that suggests that some alcoholism is actually sugar addiction, because alcohol is converted by the liver into sugar very, very rapidly, and a large chunk of the high that people get from alcohol, or not so much the high, the crash, actually, the relaxation, the tiredness that they get from alcohol is a consequence of the sugar going spiking up, and then insulin spiking up, and then the crash in blood sugar.
There actually has been some research suggesting that. Yeah, there's also been some research suggesting that a lot of people who are alcoholics actually have a problem with hypoglycemia, which is the problem that I had back in 1998. And that's what kind of led me to my sugar discovery.
Right. Now, in your book, there's a chapter about sugar, you know, the health consequences. Actually, there's several chapters about the health consequences of sugar. You know, you talk about pimples, I think the one that everybody would intuit. But then wrinkles?
Wrinkles, yes. Yes,
how can sugar cause wrinkles? We know about smoker's face. We're starting to see it in Laura Bush, for example. But, you know, wrinkles from sugar?
Well, basically, what tends to happen is you eat a lot of sweets, so it raises your blood sugar levels. That overstimulates insulin release, and that triggers inflammation. And that could contribute to, more than 150 health problems, and wrinkles is just one of them, as well as obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you know, severe PMS, failing memory, mental confusion, irritability, forgetfulness, nightmare. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. But, yeah, there's actual documented proof that you can age more quickly if you eat a lot of sweets. So one girl I interviewed for my book, it was pretty funny. She goes, well, you know, I first got off sugar for my sanity, but now I stay off it for my vanity.
That's interesting. You know, I think it's important also for us to remember that sugar was not really part of the diet of most peoples all around the world until a relatively recent period of time.
Until we process the heck out of all these foods. And by the way, when I say sugar, I also mean processed carbs, because it works in your body in a similar way.
So Wonder Bread is the same as eating sugar? Or
there's a reason. Yep. There's research that suggests those.
Are there different kinds of sugars?
Carbs.
I mean, for example, when I'm having a sugar craving, and there's that confession, right? I discovered long ago that if I'm just in a regular store or drugstore and I pick up a candy bar, it's full of high fructose corn syrup, and I swore off the stuff a few years ago, and actually I lost about an inch around my waist as a consequence of just not eating high fructose corn syrup. And you'd be amazed the number of people who call this program and say just taking that out of their diet did it. But I'll look for a candy bar that's sweetened with cane sugar. Is there a difference, you know, or even organic, you know? it seems organic. It seems. Is there a real difference in types of sugar?
Well, basically, I think they're all equal opportunity destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
But there has been some research suggesting that high fructose corn syrup is processed differently in our bodies, and that it could lead to, you know, to obesity and heart disease
and that kind of thing.
But seriously, I'm not a big fan of any of the sweeteners. Yeah. If you consume them too much, you know, too much of them, which is what the typical American does. So it's not like somebody's saying, oh, I don't have that much. No, the fact of the matter is the average American is consuming roughly, you know, 170 pounds. That's, I don't know, a little less than a cup a day of sugar.
Wow.
And that doesn't even include all of the processed carbohydrates. So over time, you know, your
you're inevitably going to get a whole bunch of ailments.
So if I decide that I'm going to kick sugar and I'm just going to go cold turkey for a week, let's say, and just, you know, no sugar whatsoever, what can I expect to have happen in my body and brain over that?
I think it depends on you know, it certainly depends on your body because everybody has a different reaction.
Sure.
Some people might experience withdrawal symptoms. There's some experts who don't believe that you should kick cold turkey. There are others who believe that that's the only way to do it. But what you have to bear in mind, if you do experience some unpleasant reactions, and of course nobody wants to experience that, ultimately you're going to feel better in the long term. So the thing to keep in mind is, why are you doing this? You know, you're going to feel so much better. So what I try to stress now when people think about, you know, they think, oh my God, they don't want to deny themselves sweets. And I'm like, wait a minute, think about the benefits that you get. So you can get more, you know, by cutting back on sugar, you know, or cutting it out, whichever you choose, you know, you can get more energy, you can focus better, you can feel better, you can have better moods, you can even have an increased libido, you know, you can, I mean, the list goes on, you know, you just feel a greater sense of overall health, and, you know, you'll look younger. So the list of benefits are tremendous.
I've heard people in the health food movement, or whatever you want to call it, over the years suggest that there's a lot of folks who have systemic infections of various types of yeast and fungi, that, or even some not so useful bacteria, that if we stopped eating sugar, would be starved out. But these yeast or bacteria or whatever, so that they crave the sugar, and so they cause us to crave the sugar. You think there's anything to that?
Well, I think there's a lot to, you know, to the fact that there's a candida connection. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it goes beyond just vaginitis kind of stuff.
Pardon me?
It goes beyond vaginitis. We're talking about something that could be systemic.
I mean, because,
and it's men and women.
Yeah, it does go away. And everybody's going to react in a different way. Now, for me, for instance, I just found it difficult to focus, or I would have these very strange heart palpitations that hit me out of the blue, or I was experiencing excessive fatigue or severe PMS. Somebody else, on the other hand, might react over time. They might develop, you know, heart disease, or, you know, somebody might develop cancer, or, you know, acne, or, you know, lots of wrinkles, or be depressed. So everybody tends to react in a different way.
Yeah, sugar is not a food that we co-evolved with. It's not part of the food that is part of the historic diet of humans.
I mean, you know, the sugar canes do grow out of the ground, but by the time we get them on our table in the little white processed form, you know, they've gone through a whole bunch of steps and processes, and, you know, they've been processed the heck out of.
Right. So, we have about a little less than a minute left, Connie Bennett.
Okay.
Sugarshock.com, the website. What's your best advice for people?
I think that's that people do what I call sugary soul searching, where they just do take an honest assessment as to what their relationship with sugar is about, kind of face their sugar truth. And then you can go from there. And, of course, I do invite people to my website, sugarshock.com, my blog, sugarshockblog.com. I have all kinds of information to help people as well.
I just want people
to remember that life can be sweeter without all of those refined sweets.
Right. I used to know William Dufty, the guy who wrote Sugar Blues.
Did you really?
Back in the 70s, yeah. He and I and Gloria Swanson used to hang out in her apartment. And
really?
He was quite a guy. I don't know if he's still around or not, I'm assuming.
No, I missed
him. Oh, he's not?
I missed him.
Oh, that's a shame. Anyhow, it was a great book. But your book, Marvelous, Sugar Shock by Connie Bennett, and the website sugarshock.com or sugarshockblog.com. Connie, great having you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott and VA Watchdog up next.
Listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Lonely feelings deep inside. Find a corner where I can hide. Silent footsteps crowding me. Sudden darkness, but I can see. No sugar tonight, I need no sugar to stand beside me.
Yeah, well, we're all going to have to rethink our relationship to sugar after that conversation. Welcome back to the program. 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott's on the line with us with VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. And, boy, you sure do a great job of it, Larry. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Good to be with you again.
What's at the top of your list today?
Well, at the top of the list, I think we should just take a few seconds anyway to mention Senator Larry Craig of Idaho. I've taken him off the front page of VA Watchdog because he's going to do what he's going to do. But we should remind our listeners he was a very, very powerful person over the last few years when it came to veterans legislation. He was the ranking member of the committee, and in the previous Congress, he was chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. He hustled through lots of legislation, and he stopped lots of other legislation. Craig has always been firmly opposed to mandatory funding for VA health care, something that the Democratic senators had tried to push through. And Craig really wasn't very well liked in veteran circles. He was well known for tantrums on the Senate floor. One particular tantrum he threw where he came out and just absolutely screamed about the veteran service organizations, you know, the VFW and the Disabled American Veterans and so forth, and said, I'm tired of them coming to me with their hands out asking for more, more, more. Well, what is the job of the veteran service organizations? It's to represent veterans and ask
How
for more.
How dare they lobby on behalf of their constituents?
Yeah, just a little bit. And Craig will not be missed, and on the Senate Veterans Committee. And what we're looking at now is whoever replaces him, whatever Republican they put on there, the general feeling is could not be any worse and is probably going to be a whole heck of a lot better for veterans and for veterans legislation in the future. So enough of Larry Craig.
He really was the worst Republican with regard to veterans in the Senate? I mean, that's quite an indictment.
He had a terrible voting record. He had a terrible voting record on veterans issues, those issues forwarded by the Veterans Service Organization. So, Larry Craig is going to go fight his fight, and we'll go off and fight other fights. One of the big stories right now is the VA budget, and that is the Senate is now, in fact, is talking about that today. It's $4 billion more for this upcoming fiscal year that starts October 1st than the White House had wanted. And although the White House says they haven't said they're going to veto this if it's passed, they're telling Senate budget negotiators, if you give veterans $4 billion more, you better take that money from some other part of the budget.
Which, in other words, don't raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires.
No, let's not raise any taxes. Remember, the Congress is now stuck in what they call pay-go. And
now, are you talking about some other part of the veterans budget or some other part of... Some other discretionary part of the budget.
Some other part of the discretionary budget. This could come out of roads, could come out of education, could come out of Medicare, Medicaid. It could come out of anything. But if you're going to spend more on veterans, you better take it from somebody else. This is part of the pay-go philosophy that the Congress is working under right now, where you either, if you want to raise a particular budget, you have to have an offset from another part of the budget, or get what they call new revenue streams. Democrats have not been really hot on new revenue streams. Which
don't these guys realize, though, that we've got 20,000-30,000 injured, I mean, severely injured soldiers from just, you know, the last couple of years in Iraq and Afghanistan, not to mention probably hundreds of thousands coming down the road with PTSD and other not quite so visible injuries. I mean, this is how do they expect to maintain an occupation in a foreign land by force of military and not somehow come up with some extra money to maintain that military without having to whack away at something else?
They're going to have to do that, and we know that, Tom. And actually that number now on wounded, injured, and ill stands at over 60,000 currently.
Oh, my.
With more than 200,000 of those having applied for services through the VA, those who've come out of the service. So it takes a little while to piece all these numbers together and to take a good solid look at them, but the number is well over 60,000. They're going to have to increase the budget. They're going to have to raise taxes. You and I know it.
Yeah, and do I understand this right, that if a veteran has an attorney representing them, that attorney can be disciplined?
Oh, yeah.
Veterans attorneys can be disciplined for malpractice, or is this good news or bad news? I guess.
It's good news because if a veteran has an attorney who misrepresents them, The U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims can discipline that attorney, the story I have up right now.
Okay, well, that's good.
Okay, that is very good. And what this means is veterans are protected in the attorney-client relationship. But this points out a real problem in the system, and that is veterans service officers, those who generally work for free and volunteer their time, might work for the VFW or the Disabled American Veterans. There is no disciplinary action or disciplinary panel to oversee any problems that they've created. So what we're really doing here is asking a question. If attorneys can be disciplined, shouldn't service officers also be? We're looking for a high standard to represent veterans.
Do the service officers typically represent the poor and indigent?
No, they represent those who generally file what we call an initial claim. It's kind of a first shot at the VA.
Interesting.
Then attorneys come in later.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bobby and Eagle and a flag tattooed on. Red, white, and blue, the moon will land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still here. Chasing ghosts and thin dry air. We went back at home. The fine has come and took his car. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Hey, if you missed our program on C-SPAN on Friday, there's a link up at the top at TomHartman.com. However you spell it will get you there. And to the C-SPAN show, you can watch all 3 hours right there on TV. It's a solid show straight through, no commercials, and not bad. You get to see what our studio looks like, see my incredibly handsome producer, David, David Poole over here, smiling at the camera. There's a little glimpse of Louise in there. A couple of quick notes, and then take your calls here. First, I made a comment last week where I said that Bill Clinton avoided removal from office in the Senate by one vote. I was echoing a Republican talking point that I've heard probably 1,000 times. And an alert listener pointed out to me that the vote was 50-50. It failed in the Senate. And it failed because the Senate can only convict with a two-thirds majority. There have to be 67 votes for conviction of Bill Clinton. And fell short by 17 votes, not one vote. So I stand corrected, and you should, you know, keep your ear out for the next time you hear some Republican promoting that meme. Secondly, loss of Arctic ice leaves experts stunned. This is from the Guardian newspaper. The Arctic ice cap has collapsed at an unprecedented rate this summer, and levels of sea ice in the region now stand at record lows. An area almost twice as big as the United Kingdom, disappeared in the last week alone. So much ice has melted this summer that the Northwest Passage across the top of Canada is now fully navigable, and observers say the Northeast Passage across Russia's Arctic coast could be open by later this month. If the increased rate of melting continues, the summertime Arctic could be totally ice-free by 2030. The Arctic has now lost about a third of its ice since satellite measurements began some 30 years ago, and the rate of loss has accelerated sharply since 2002.
Yeah, but there's no global warming. You don't have to worry about it, don't you know?
Yes, thank you very much, ExxonMobil. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Rachel in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's Narlodius in Denver. You know, I just wanted to tell you something about the high fructose corn syrup that you mentioned, which is very interesting. It's not actually natural substance in contrast to its name. It's the enzymatic byproduct of the digestion of corn starch, and in the process of making ethanol, the byproduct is high fructose corn syrup. And
oh, that's interesting. I knew that it was a chemical and not a food. I didn't realize that it was the byproduct of making ethanol. So we're going to see even more cheaper high fructose corn syrup if we move more and more toward ethanol?
That's exactly right, because as we get into more and more ethanol production, we're going to see more and more of this corn syrup byproduct that will need to be disposed of, because after all, the consumer in this equation is the disposal pipeline, because it's very hard to get rid of if you can't distribute it throughout the, you know, the food products that we consume.
This is why we need to go to hemp and biodiesel rather than corn and ethanol. Corn is a really inefficient way to convert sunlight into a fuel
to
begin
with. Well, that's exactly right, but it does produce so many other valuable byproducts used in a lot of things. And, you know, I'm just afraid that what will happen is if we do manage to control the corn syrup problem, it will just become a commodity to export to developing nations where they'll suffer the same fate that we've been suffering.
Yeah, well, I think it already is, Rachel. I think it already is. But thank you for that information. Interesting.
Thanks.
I didn't know that. Appreciate the call. Larry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well, but I will get better. What's up?
Well, I really want to congratulate you on clearly identifying high fructose corn syrup as a drug. It is, I'm a family doctor, and in my practice, when I explain to people how to help eliminate sugars, simple carbohydrates from their diet, I liken high fructose corn syrup and other simple sugars as a drug very similar to the action of other highly addictive drugs like Xanax. Xanax is in the Valium family, and the reason why it's so addictive is because it has a fast on, fast off type of profile in terms of how it's handled by the body.
So for a drug that probably more people would be familiar with, if not personally, at least through pop culture, you could say that high fructose corn syrup is the crack cocaine of carbohydrates, whereas, white rice is just the cocaine or cane sugar is the cocaine of it.
I think that that's actually a very fair statement. And it is, I think that once people become aware of that, then in addition, start to read labels, and then I think that they have a better chance of working to eliminate it from their diet. But it is, in my mind, high fructose corn syrup and other simple sugars are essentially just drugs, and I think that the food companies probably have food chemists working on this day and night to try to get us addicted to their products. It's not about health, it's about money.
Yeah, well, it worked well for the tobacco industry, and they probably have their own lobby and industry out there, and their own little research centers, debating and.
Yeah.
Oh,
there,
good grief.
There is another sweetening product called stevia. I don't know.
Stevia. Yeah, it's an herb actually, and it's
right.
Very, very sweet, and it has no calories at all, and it's pure, it's totally natural, and it doesn't have the side effects of some of these chemicals like aspartame brought to you by Don Rumsfeld, oddly enough.
And the FDA has not approved stevia as a sweetener. It is approved, I believe, as a supplement.
Yeah.
So
they haven't approved it as a sweetener because there's no pressure from industry to do so because it can't be patented because it's a natural product. And so
right.
Nobody can make a huge fortune off it the way they can like aspartame.
Right.
But you're right. I've been using it for a long time. And in fact, I mix a little bit of stevia with a little bit of coffee in the morning and sweeten my coffee.
Yeah.
And, it's just, I can't notice a difference, and it's great stuff. Larry, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Got to move along.
Take care.
Thank you.
All right,
thank you very much. Yeah, you too. Bye now. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Janice.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I lived in the British Virgin Islands for 2.5 years. I married a man from there. And it was interesting because it was sort of like watching, history real quick because they didn't, my mother-in-law didn't have electricity until she was 50. And so, what I got to see is a radical change in their diet. And they would chew on sugarcane. And they didn't have cavities. And they said that's because there was B vitamins in the sugarcane. And now they switched over to like our Domino sugar and all that, and they're having all kinds of diseases down there.
Sure. Well, you know, they say molasses is really good for you, and I think molasses is the stuff that's left over when they refine the sugar out of sugar cane, isn't it?
I believe so. But I had to ask, too, in the health food stores, you still find things with corn syrup. Yeah, corn syrup in them. Now, I don't get those. Is that just as bad for you as the high fructose corn syrup?
My understanding is that old-fashioned corn syrup is actually just, it's not all that sweet. It's like the old Karo syrup stuff. It's not, you know, it's not particularly sweet. High fructose corn syrup is this new chemical that, as Rachel pointed out, is a result of an enzymatic process that was developed back in the 1970s and is a completely different and brand new chemical in our food supply that, I mean, go out and Google high fructose corn syrup and obesity or just high fructose corn syrup. You'll just be startled by what you find. Janice, thanks a lot for the call. Mariana in Queens, New York. Hey, Mariana.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to say, I was wondering if I'm the only person who feels on a daily basis like I'm living in a George Orwell book.
You can put me in that category. I certainly see the parallels to 1984 right now.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, as in healthcare, as in many other areas, we just do not call things what they are. I mean, healthcare would be in a society where you cannot profit from someone dying. I mean, basically, I mean, corporations are really making it impossible for us to get anything called that you would call healthcare. Maybe there's health management or health monitoring or some mad scientist thing going on. But how can we hold people, how can we hold government accountable if we are not really, we don't even know the questions to ask, and we're not asking,
well,
you know, we're not asking where is the funding coming from for this research, or, you know,
we're
not holding anybody accountable. And
step one, Mariana, is to start electing people who actually believe in government, that government can govern. As long as we have people who believe that government cannot govern, who believe that everything that government does is wrong, everything government does is dysfunctional, they cannot govern. I mean, it's just a simple fact. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. And as a consequence of that, they're going to screw it up as they have, particularly the Republicans. They're going to use it as a place where their cronies can dip in and take all they can and run with it, as they have, particularly the Republicans. But there are, you know, not an insignificant number of Democrats who fall into this category too, because there is so much money out there, and there is human nature and greed at work. And this is where I think, you know, the stands that people like John Edwards and Dennis Kucinich are taking about, you know, we're not going to take money from these folks, is so powerful and so strong.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, old TV shows, and snow.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. And Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com on the Internet is on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
I think it's amazing that the Pentagon just sort of hastily gave a little briefing, this spokesperson Jeff Morrell, essentially saying that these nuclear armaments that were supposedly transported across the country from Minot, North Dakota, to Barksdale, they would not say whether these, it was a 6-hour flight, they were attached to B-52s, and they would not say whether they were active nuclear armaments, would not discuss it. However, President Bush has been notified, so you can draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, is this a case where I mean, this is just a screw-up, or did we almost nuke ourselves? I mean, what happened here?
It's very hard to read between the lines, and I honestly don't know enough about how the Air Force functions, and our very own Air Force person who's on our staff, Charlene Espinosa, is flying today. So I'll have to get the story later, but my guess is that was a giant screw-up.
Yeah, after you've talked to Charlene, I'd love to know what she has to say, because I know she was an Air Force pilot and would probably have some sense of this. Because you read several different stories out there in the media, and all of them kind of have this undercurrent of, you know, either there was a screw up or, you know, what was going on, or was this part of something that was, you know, intended to send a message to the Soviet Union now that they've put their nuclear, you know, weapons in the air all the time, but then it wasn't. And, you know, it's a very, very strange. What else is happening in Washington, D.C.?
There's actually quite a bit. I just want to mention two deaths and an illness. Jennifer Dunn, remember her, Republican from Washington State. She was found dead in her apartment. Representative, and she's no longer in Congress, but Paul Gilmore, a Republican from Ohio, the Toledo area, was also found dead in his apartment. And Tim Johnson, just I'm at the Senate right now, just a few minutes ago, gave his speech, his coming back speech. His speech is still not where it should be, but he is there, and that was good news.
So here we have, in one day, we have a Democrat who had been severely injured by something resembling a stroke coming back, and we have two Democrats and two Republicans struck dead.
Yes.
What would Jerry Falwell say about this?
I don't know what he would say, but it wouldn't be very pretty. You know,
is God trying to tell us something here?
Exactly. Probably like it if it were the other way. The other thing was really interesting. I went just went to a briefing or a little presser that Senator Clinton did with Jerry Nadler and Carolyn Maloney. And it turns out that the GAO, yes, has another report out today called the World Trade Center EPA's Most Recent Test and Clean Program Raises Concerns That Need to Be Addressed. Well, essentially, the bottom line is they did not check these buildings, the reports of contaminated buildings since 9/11 in New York City has still been swept under the rug.
Going back to Giuliani,
but it was interesting. The senators tried to sort of avoid putting it on Giuliani and put it back on Bush, which may have.
Well, everybody's trying to toss everything on Bush now. I mean, you've got right-wing commentators like Joe Scarborough spending all his time trashing Bush. Michael Savage spends all his time trashing Bush. All these guys who were just absolutely in love with George Bush, now that it's obvious that he's not running for anything. And so the people who
it's a safe trash.
Right, yeah, and you know, they can still promote the Republican Party and their bizarre Reaganistic you know, memes and worldview, and yet have people feel like well, they're a little bit fair and balanced after all. They're picking on George Bush as if he was running for something.
I mean, for sure. And of course, the other thing so this is interesting because it really shows that they just have not done what's needed to be done at 9/11. Of course, the other issue that is popping up here is Congress and everybody. I'm telling you, I've heard conspiracy theories up the yin yang today about Senator Craig and did they know that he visits that restroom often so that they set something up? And people are really going crazy on the conspiracy theories up here.
Oh, you mean people suggesting that he was the victim of a sting operation that was intended to get him, not because some parents had complained to the police that their kids were being harassed in this particular bathroom.
That apparently the speculation that I've heard from a couple people up here now in the Senate building here are that this was something that he may have visited frequently because he certainly supposedly knew where he was, and so they, knowing what flights or whatever, I don't know but I got to tell you that there are speculations up here, and his staffer just said that he is going to see, may remain in the Senate if he gets through ethics and if he can get this charge overturned.
That Larry Craig,
naughty
he
boy,
is.
Bad boy, a naughty boy, a nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, there's a funny picture up on the top of Huffington Post, two women holding signs. One says, it's 12:15 p.m. Do you know which stall your senator is in? And the other one says, Craig is a nasty, naughty boy.
Well, I think it's very clear. This morning, there was a briefing that was actually held by not Harry Reid, but somebody in his sort of environs in office. And the only thing people are focused on is Larry Craig. And usually, after the Senate, Senate Republican and Democratic conferences, there are all kinds of pressers. There's just nothing of that today. It's quiet as a mouse up here.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Because that's all the people are asking about.
Yeah, and Congress is officially beginning business now?
Congress is, they're doing it.
They're officially back, yeah. Okay. Ellen Renner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Michael Chapman is here, claiming there is an end to marriage in California. Hey, what? Edward Hartman, is going to be talking about when growth isn't always good. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, News Below the Radar, and the best of the rest of the news. Steve Rendell of Fair.org and Nancy Scola of AirAmerica.com are here, along with your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.